Thanks so much for coming, everyone. I'm happy to introduce my good friend and former Fortune colleague, Chris Cipone, who's been one of the early adopters or leaders in covering Russia's involvement in Western social media. And welcome him all the way from down under. Chris?
I got the mic here. Oh, mic's up here. Thanks, Jenna. Yep, definitely. Okay, so thank you for coming to my talk today on how the tech world aids Russia's war on the West. Now, I'm going to talk about a few different things in this speech, in this discussion. One is about the culture of the tech world in the West. One is going to be about Edward Snowden, because you sort of can't not talk about him. We'll also talk about the difference between the information security, information war view versus the cybersecurity, cyber war view, which makes up a sort of East-West divide. I'm also going to talk about libertarianism online. I'm going to speak a little bit about free speech and anonymous speech, because that's central to this issue in the West. And then I'll also talk a little bit about some big picture issues with democracy online. I'll conclude with that. So before I go any further, I should probably explain how I came to talk about this issue and to know about it. I'm a foreign news editor at The Age in Melbourne, Australia. I'm also a fellow at the Futures Council at the National Security College at the Australian National University. Now, working on the Age's foreign news desk around 2015, I noticed an uptick in stories about Russian information war coming from Europe, and Eastern Europe in particular, but then eventually through Europe. So in 2016, when that rolled around, I had a suspicion that that Russia would have some involvement in the 2016 election. So consequently, I was, to the best of my knowledge, one of the first journalists in the English-speaking world to publish an article on Russia's information war efforts in 2016 during the election while it was happening. The story that was published then was completed for about a month, and I was basically just waiting for some sort of signal to know that it was time to publish, and I was agonizing. From Australia, I even tried to contact a couple journalists that were following the U.S. election here in the U.S., but, you know, to no avail, basically. So from there, the story has only continued. And now we find ourselves here today, all of us basically wondering how democracy is going to survive, not just the onslaught of propaganda and influence campaigns, but the technology that supercharges their effect and their reach. So the sort of scene setter to what happened in 2016, and the most recent chapter, I believe, in the modern era of Russian influence on the West begins with the Edward Snowden story. Snowden's revelations and messaging haven't just driven a wedge between the U.S. government and the tech sector, but between the U.S. government and other democratic governments. This was a sort of prelude to Russia's meddling in the U.S. election, which itself was a multi-year affair. But when talking about Snowden, it's not so much a story of bots or Facebook ads. It's really a story of ideas. You can never underestimate the power of ideas and influence and propaganda. The trick, of course, is getting the right messages in front of the right crowds in the West. So as Russian foreign policy expert Ivan Timofeev said as much in 2016, the success for a propaganda specialist lies in the ability to identify mental sets and target them with relevant media messages. If the target is hit, it only strengthens the pre-existing mindset. So, given the mindset of the tech world and its elite status within Western society, if you can shape perceptions there through ideas, you can have a profound effect on the broader terms of the debate. If Russia could, say, tip the scales in the perennial debate about liberty and security, and that's a debate that goes back to the foundation of the United States, it could skew the public's view on the matter and potentially hobble a government's ability to react. And that is what I believe has happened in the lead up with Edward Snowden to the 2016 election. As a former Eastern Bloc official said during the Cold War, he once explained, a powerful adversary can only be defeated through a sophisticated, methodical, careful, and shrewd effort to exploit even the smallest cracks between our enemies and within their elites. So that quote came to mind watching the Apple executive Tim Cook in 2016 take a public adversarial stand toward the FBI when it had asked for assistance in unlocking the encrypted phone of a deceased terror suspect. The FBI's then director, James Comey, even went before Congress in an open hearing to make the law enforcement agency's case about the use of encryption. So why would the CEO of a company like Apple take such a defiant stand? Could it be that the liberty or privacy side of the debate has been amplified, leaving those in the tech sector to feel as if they've been victimized by the government? You have Tim Cook, James Comey, two elites divided, 3 years after the Snowden story broke. Now, their division is representative of a much bigger liberty security divide being worsened and hardened in a democracy built on principled compromise. It's not that what Snowden has said since 2013 is all false. It's that what Snowden says is often only partially true. Robert Litt, a lawyer for the Director of National Intelligence, said that besides giving information to enemies, Snowden's disclosures have also had a radicalizing effect in the private sector. The technology and communications community has moved from a position of willingness to cooperate to an attitude that ranges from neutrality to outright hostility. Now, that's something that I've heard repeated here since I've been at South by Southwest from various people that are aware of the situation with the government background. They've said the same thing. In this way, the arguments of Snowden, amplified and repeated, have an influence on our society. We know now, thanks to the Mueller indictments of the 13 Russians and three Russian entities, that efforts to influence the U.S. election were already in place by 2014. Whether by design or chance, the perceptions in the tech sector set the scene for the information offensive to come. Again, whether by design or chance, they helped constrain the White House in what it could do or say in the lead up to the 2016 election outcome. So, a central question is if privacy is worth protecting from our own government's overreach, isn't our security worth protecting from the government, from other governments' meddling hands as well? If it is, people in the tech community should stop and think for a second about the political backdrop to the Edward Snowden story. Snowden's revelations and messaging haven't just driven a wedge between the U.S. government and the tech sector, but between the U.S. government and other Western democratic governments. In 2016, the director of Germany's domestic intelligence service, Hans-Georg Maaßen, said that Snowden's case wasn't just an espionage operation, but, quote, an operation for disinformation and influence in order to drive a wedge between the U.S. and its closest allies, especially Germany. Others note that Snowden has reframed spying itself to falsely suggest that we're living in a global panopticon where all Western citizens' activities are being tracked by the NSA moment to moment. If you feel victimized by your government, it changes your thinking. Meanwhile, I watched from the Age's newsroom as data acquired by Snowden has also been used to spark a diplomatic crisis between Australia and Indonesia in 2013. Now, none of this denies the real issue of liberty versus security, which Snowden speaks about so frequently. It's just that this issue has been co-opted for Russia's gain. And there is a centuries-old history of Russia co-opting real controversies in the West's open society for their own gain. Now, for the best examples of this, we have to look back beyond the Cold War, which really only began at the end of World War II. We have to look back to the early part of the 20th century, when East-West competition was much more fluid. Not only were Western writers and intellectuals brought into the orbit of Russian influence through co-opted idealism, the Kremlin tried to take an active hand in shaping perceptions of the U.S. abroad as well. And one of the chief ways they did this was to ramp up emotion around political prisoners in the capitalist world until they became international cause celebs. One example is the trial of Italian anarchists Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, accused of murder in Massachusetts in 1920. Being foreign-born anarchists during the first Red Scare in the United States hardly endeared the duo to the U.S. public at the time. After a hasty trial resulting in their death sentence, liberals, anarchists, writers, and statesmen rallied to Sacco and Vanzetti's side, demanding that their case be reopened. Before long, news of the case spread, spurring organized protests, letter-writing campaigns, and petitions. By 1925, the protests were occurring around the world with increasing intensity and size. Sacco and Vanzetti were executed in 1927. Years after the trial, it emerged that Moscow had backed the international campaign of protest against the treatment of the Italians in what historian Sean McMeekin described as the greatest propaganda event of the year. In addition to a real legal case in the U.S. legal system, the campaign was also likely an effort to discredit the U.S. reputation among the international working class, especially as Soviet communism purported to present itself as the, or sought to present itself as the only alternative to the world's workers. As French novelist Henri Barbusse wrote at the time, and there's that quote there, the Sacco and Vanzetti case will engender everlasting hatred on the part of the working masses and be condemned by all loyal, wise, and enlightened spirits whom it will transform into enemies of a system of domination. The system of domination? The U.S. So a real issue, the real trial of two anarchists used for other purposes, winning influence while discrediting an adversary. The Sacco and Vanzetti case is just the most famous cause célèbre exploited this way. There were quite a few others into the 1930s. So there's, you might recognize some of them, the Scottsboro Boys case, which involved black youths that were unfairly, unjustly accused of rape in Alabama. There's also the Spanish Civil War, which was the subject of lots of propaganda at the time to rally and galvanize support for positions that were favorable to the Soviet Union. Applying the same dynamics today, the internet allows new possibilities. With the internet, the protagonist no longer even need to be in a U.S. jail cell. The protagonist could be in voluntary exile. He can be in an embassy with internet connection. He can be anywhere, as long as the messages come back to the key audiences in the West. Such an influence campaign can play out over years, as Sacco and Vanzetti's did. But to do this sort of thing, the elites of the West must be brought on board. And here, the cause claims the highest of the moral high ground. Seeing the unquestioned position Snowden has in the tech community, even among notables, brings to mind the communist-cultivated cause célèbres of the past. There is an appeal to emotion, there is a strategy to woo elites, there is the perceived victimization of the hero, and there is a distortion of the facts in the debate. Of course, this too is the modus operandi of old Russian propaganda campaigns, courting the elites in the West to shift the opinion of the public. In the 1920s and 30s, the writers and artists and intellectuals were the cutting edge. These days, the tech world functions as the cutting edge. The tech world pushes the boundaries of what is new and possible and permissible in the way that artists and writers once did 100 years ago. Until recently, Silicon Valley was viewed with a sort of awe, their output considered a kind of magic for society, and politicians courted the executives. I think that dynamic has changed somewhat in the past year or past 2 years. It's tempting to think, though, that we have entered a new age when old rules don't apply. It's tempting to think the Snowden story exists outside our geopolitical reality. Unfortunately, the geopolitical backdrop makes it unlikely that if Russia really thought that Snowden were helping to reform the U.S. security state or the U.S. and help the U.S. in any way, that they would permit him a platform online. It just seems highly unlikely. And so, since 2013, when the privacy side of the debate has achieved maximum weight, we have to think again about our security, not from terrorism, but the security of our whole network called democracy. Now, don't think for a moment that my message to you is that you need to trust the NSA or FBI or CIA or any American agency. It's not. But I hope that in the current geopolitical environment, you distrust the hostile security agencies just a little bit more, and that you understand that a big part of their work is the subversion of democracy. Also, bear in mind that while questioning the power of Western states is a recurring theme to the defenders of cyberspace, it turns out that it was the private sector social media platforms operating pretty freely from public oversight that were the force that helped enable a demagogue to enter the White House. Now, I'd like to speak a little bit about the tech culture of the West. For all the West's cyber defense capabilities, it has been the area of opinion that has stood most open for manipulation. And it was many of the elites in the tech world who were most blind to the damaging notions being seeded into the Western political debate. Some dispute the description of tech company executives as libertarian as much as optimistic in nature. Based on his own 2015 polling of Silicon Valley startup leaders, author Greg Ferenstein concluded as much. And he defined optimists as having two core assumptions about the world. Change will nearly always make things better, and there's no inherent conflict between major groups in society. So that's workers versus corporations, or citizens versus government, or America versus other nations. This optimism itself, if misplaced, could easily be viewed from afar as a kind of naivete for the world. It helps explain how Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales could tweet, "I believe in the elimination of borders and free commerce as a route to peace. Barriers necessarily imply violence." Such infotopian ideas embrace a worldview that assumes the best from others. They also assume a certain level of shared values, say a respect for property rights and the rule of law and even the motivations of people. I appreciate the optimism that they embody. Confronting Russia today, however, the tech world's ideology appears to be a huge vulnerability, because Russia wants to actively challenge the West in almost every domain. This isn't simply about land grabs on Russia's border, it's about grabbing the global imagination. Russian media and influence campaigns rely aggressively on conspiracy theory spread over the internet. As you may know, the reach of outlets like RT expanded through social media and alternative news sites. If a conspiracy theory seeks to divide the world into two camps, the power elite and the underdog masses for whom it explains the world, Russia has increasingly positioned itself as a spokesman for the global underdog. If people are motivated by psychologically seductive conspiracy theories promoted by Russian outlets, Russia gets the run of the Western information space to amplify them, then the values of Western democracy will get worn down over time. Russia has been and will continue to weave together lasting networks of influence over social media in the West. The US and West, if unable to defend their own debate online, will never return to reasonable politics, but remain locked in a spectacle of dysfunction. In this way, the imaginative blindness toward the possibility of other non-Western governments interfering in our debate online has aided Russia in its attack on the West. But there is another strain of thinking in tech subcultures, like hackers and among privacy activists and crypto activists, that creates a vulnerability in the West as well. It stems from the countercultural urges found right at the beginning of the early days of personal computing. In the early days, before the World Wide Web was a mainstream thing, there was a notion or appeal of personal liberation through computing. These ideas were adopted in part from the communitarian ethos of the 1960s counterculture. Media scholar Fred Turner writes that the search for utopia that led a generation to live on communes in the 1970s, cut off from broader society, eventually found expression in the early culture of personal computing and the internet. In this way, early American notions of cyberspace began to conceive of the domain as that of individuals, free from the constraints of the broad mainstream society with its unthinking authority, its institutions, and its wars. Cyberspace, as envisioned then, was a world apart, adhering to its own set of rules. The problem, then, is that the communitarian ethos of the tech world is by preference philosophically separated from the broader issues of society and politics. In this way, when WikiLeaks began to use information hacked by Russians to try to tip the US election, many, too many in the tech world, seemed to view this not as an assault on democracy, but the actions of one person, Julian Assange, against the reputation of another set of individuals, Hillary Clinton, John Podesta, among others. In other words, it was just the individual fates of networked individuals. Another example, Mark Zuckerberg's pledge to defend against interference by nation states as one of his personal challenges for the year. While it's great the Facebook founder now recognizes the problem, casting it as a personal challenge fundamentally misses the public nature of the threat. It also exposes how deeply ingrained in the culture this thinking is in the tech world, in my opinion. Russia's use of Facebook to thwart US democracy is a problem affecting the whole. It's affecting not just social media, but society. the communitarian libertarian streak in the tech world simply doesn't allow for this reality. Born of a time when the US was not just a military superpower, but the undisputed economic hegemon, the indifference towards geopolitical risk from that time and place, the early 1990s, has crystallized into a worldview for too many in the tech world. Inasmuch as this reflects the culture of the tech world, it's not a simple matter to change it. The culture itself must change. One of the seminal figures in the early tech culture was John Perry Barlow, who recently passed away. In 1996, Barlow wrote in his famous manifesto, "Governments of the industrial world, you weary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of the mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You are not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather." For these early activists, and for many today, the chief adversary on the newly emerged cyberspace is their own government. This idea helped color the thinking in the early crypto wars between the hackers and the government. Both sides were trying to get their heads around the technology. One side had the technological advantage by being there all the time, while the other had the authority and the prosecutors. Back in the early 1990s, the US government's Operation Sun Devil spurred the creation of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. From there, the mutual estrangement between the government and hackers, crypto activists, and privacy activists grew, and it lives on today. In trying to explain why these activists remain so notoriously anti-Western government, one experienced info security consultant told me, they aren't pro-Pinochet or something. In other words, such activists aren't actively pro-fascist. True. And yet, simply being against something without being for a set of broad, relatively pro-democracy political principles leaves a lot of room for manipulation. And so, it's not hard to insert a figure of liberation, a cause celeb, into that space, an Assange or a Snowden, or figures who perform similar functions, with ideas that, if you follow them to their logical conclusion, are pretty toxic for democracy. For many intimately involved in technology in the West, there is no inbuilt defense against the anti-democratic messages that these figures engage in and promote. Despite the fact that many in Silicon Valley, if not most, have liberal leanings, a libertarian zeal for markets also makes it hard to understand the new geopolitical reality dawning on us. For example, even as countries like China take a dramatic turn against liberal democratic values, even as they have stolen Western IP on an industrial scale through hacking, Silicon Valley companies court Beijing for access to its markets. In the past 2 years, some of the same CEOs have skipped testifying in Congress about the effects that their platforms have had on fundamentally weakening democracy. It's not simply the lack of awareness that sends a negative message to democracy citizens, or that it underscores a lack of accountability in corporate America. Rather, these companies demonstrate an ignorance for the fundamental political reality outside the engineered world of tech commerce. Now, the East-West info cyber divide. The problem afflicting the tech world is not all cultural. There's also an element of genuine confusion about the approach to the internet between the East and West that comes into play. It's easy, if you come from the Western world of technology, to approach the issue of propaganda and influence from an engineering mindset. Yet, when we talk about attack or defense online, we speak about them differently between East and West. When we talk about security on the internet in the West, we talk about cybersecurity. Ensuring that the networks are stable and secure from information, stable and secure, so information can flow over them unimpeded and uncorrupted. In authoritarian nations, information security is the main game, and it focuses on content as much as networks. The most vivid recent example comes from China, where the announcement that their leader Xi Jinping is seeking or has sought to become basically leader for life. Once that news was published, there was an immediate reaction both domestically and overseas, and censors moved very quickly to suppress that knowledge from passing through and flowing through their networks. This is information control. The cyber info duality is why many Western countries have been so unprepared for information war. For decades, they've been primarily focused on cyber war and cybersecurity. It's a different animal. It's also why even if Western agencies, companies, individuals get cybersecurity 100% right, they still may have no real defense against information war. It's a different battle. And it relies much more on information, perception, content, emotions, right? It's the content. Which companies support the information security view and which support the cybersecurity view? This map provides a clue, and it is just a clue, okay? On the one side, you have the governments that have voted for a greater government role in regulating the internet. You can see them there grayed out, particularly Russia and China. On the other, you've got the ones that were against that role that are led by much more of the cyber view. And I have to caution you, this isn't an exact read on where all countries stand, because there's also countries in the developing world that would have favored more of the information view for non-authoritarian reasons. How did these vastly different views on the internet and governance occur? As the Western culture around the internet emerged in the 1990s with its libertarian defense of the network and free speech, something entirely different was happening in places like Russia and China. After the end of the Soviet Union and the ensuing chaos, the information coming over the internet presented yet one more Western threat. Russia in 1999 called for laws preventing the threat of the use of information technologies and means to influence social consciousness with a view to destabilizing a society and state. The next year, Russia adopted a doctrine that considered information security as the foundation of security of the state. Information weapons were identified as one of the instruments to pursue political objectives. Like China, Russia has sought a more sovereign internet, one in which the government has veto power over the sort of information that's flowing over it. China and Russia in 2012 led a group of developing world members of the International Telecommunications Union in the voting for an information security alliance to assure more government control over the internet, and that's what this map refers to. In 2013, in discussing the YouTube dominating Russia today, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said the country aimed to break the Anglo-Saxon monopoly on global information streams. The next year, there were media reports of Russian bloggers weighing into the Scottish independence referendum. As the recent Mueller indictment suggests, Russians were organizing to influence the US election in 2014. So that's an active intervention in the US information space. Viewing these events over time, you can see how two decades ago, the Western openness posed a threat to Moscow and the power structure there. Now, Moscow's strategic approach online, its information war, is a threat to the US. But so much of the West tech world has until recently missed this point. Instead, voices of tech activists, crypto activists, and libertarians, especially given the popularity of libertarian thought in the tech world, dominated the discussion around tech and security. While the majority of the tech world may not be libertarian, the role of influential libertarians in the tech world cannot be denied. At the top, you have people like Jeff Bezos, Peter Thiel, Jimmy Wales, but also, crucially, Wired magazine founder Louis Rossetto. John McAfee ran for the Libertarian Party presidential nomination in 2016. Edward Snowden donated to Libertarian candidate Ron Paul's presidential campaign in 2012. And Julian Assange in 2010 said he was inspired by American libertarianism, market libertarianism. These are a few of the figures who have been described at varying times and degrees as libertarian. It's not for nothing that the Russian channel RT hosted a libertarian presidential campaign or presidential debate in 2016 and a similar one in 2012. And for years, it has had as among its favored guests, Ron Paul. Again, it's the power of ideas. The Western states libertarians oppose from the inside are the same ones that are being assaulted from the outside by authoritarian states like Russia and China. The strange affinity between Western libertarians and authoritarian states has been noted by others. Jamie Bartlett from the British think tank Demos said, "Radical libertarians and autocrats are allied by virtue of sharing an enemy, which is the mainstream, soft, establishment, liberal politics. Again, you could just consider this a quirk if a major theme to Russian propaganda didn't urge a full-throated attack against the West political center, essentially the place where, until recently, most of us lived. That center is an open, tolerant political society that doesn't seek to define itself by scapegoating others. Liberal democracies are the modern heir to the Enlightenment, the period when Western society began to replace kings with law as a system of rule. Compare the libertarian urge to assail mainstream politics with that of the philosophy of Russian ultranationalist Alexander Dugin. If you don't know Dugin, he promotes a political theory beyond the left and right to attack the center. He advised Russian leaders in the 1990s, it is especially important to introduce geopolitical disorder into American activity. And that's what we've seen. The philosophical overlap between libertarianism online and Russian liberalism in a figure like Dugin, who is overtly anti-Western, is telling. When you look at the polarization of American politics in the context of someone like Dugin, who sits at the center of a virtual cargo cult of radical organizations and personas in the West, including alt-right leader Richard Spencer, you can see how libertarianism acts as a sort of gateway drug to a lot of other intolerant ideas that corrode our political system. So, the ideology of certain tech countercultures is another way in which the community is susceptible to malign influence from Russia. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about free speech online. Now, there can be a fundamentalism to some political issues in the tech world that really is akin to the Second Amendment crowd when it comes to guns. That is, there's one inflexible ideological view through which all events are interpreted. I think free speech is one of those issues for the tech world, especially in how it regards anonymous speech or a pseudonymous speech. Technology activists celebrate Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 because it frees websites and online services from the responsibility over most user-generated content, allowing them to develop their companies without the fear of onerous lawsuits. 20 years later, it's this law that helps free social media companies to exist at such a scale with so little oversight on content. So, what happened between 1996 and now? Speech has moved from the manufacturing economy of print to the information economy created by the internet. In that time, published speech has lost its scarcity. At the same time, anonymous speech has scaled up dramatically from isolated cases to whole armies of accounts online. I can't think of a period in the history of democracy when masses of voices with their identities hidden has ever had a legitimate role in determining debate. So this is different from anonymity in voting, but I'm talking about in participation in the conversation with anonymity. I don't think democracy was meant to function this way. Yet even today, when free speech issues online emerge, too many in the tech world are quick to dismiss taking action as some form of censorship. They wave what I call the free speech wand, which essentially shuts down the discussion while casting others, often falsely, as enemies of free speech. The reality, of course, is much different. Speech that undermines the very functioning of a nation might be a type of expression that draws critical scrutiny. Speech that can be spread not on the strength of the argument, but the strength of the coding script is another area. Conspiracy theory that blocks out space for genuine news, both in the mind and online, is another type that seems hard to justify. These days, in reality, free speech is too often the battle cry for people online aiming to spread ideas anonymously because they're repulsive or they're meant to disrupt or corrupt legitimate political conversation. But instead of talking about the free speech wand applied to political issues, let's put it in the context of something that we can all relate to at this moment. Let's suppose that this is another successful year for South by Southwest. People attend these great conferences, and they get a glimpse of new technology to come, and new ideas for its implementation, new ideas for the intersection of tech and society. They have fantastic, productive conversations that form the seeds of new business ideas, new ideas for the productive application of technology. But suppose 2 months from now, it emerges that fully 25% of the presentations in companies, and indeed even experts, were fake. Not obviously fake, half fake, subtly fake, fake with bad information blended in with good information. Over time, it slowly became apparent that what many people at South by Southwest were exposed to were hours of data that, while appearing genuine, were in fact falsified. So how do you navigate South by Southwest if you're not sure that what you saw and heard was real and genuine? Over time, the distrust would erode the value of the event and the conversation held at the event. And when the information can't be trusted, a slow paralysis sets in. The utility of the conversation of the event erodes. That's what is happening in the Western political sphere right now. And many of the worst offenders, either committed or duped into various causes, claim free speech as a battle cry. Now, I'm not talking about political spin, which is as old as politics itself. Spin can be sifted and debunked, and the public can evaluate for themselves who the worst abusers are. I'm not talking about the individual words and ideas used by any one person. I'm talking about a coordinated action that uses communication to undermine the system as a whole. Cloaking such tainted information as free speech essentially obscures the attack on the information network, whether the network is a Western democracy or South by Southwest. In both cases, rather than trying to disrupt the connections, like in a cyber attack, it leaves those intact, it leaves those in place, but it carries the assault directly to the end users via the content, through the information, through like an information war. And that is what is happening in democracy now. It's what is happening to democracy now. And this is what the free speech wand fails to address. It's not offensive speech. The issue with speech in this case isn't an individual's right, but the requirement of a larger democratic society or network, if you will, to be able to function correctly. When you see the way conspiracy, rumor, false news are pumped through accuracy-agnostic social media platforms to disrupt, deflect, confuse, polarize legitimate debate, the challenge for our political values becomes clear. And it's quite telling to me that in 2018, trust between strangers online is hardly a problem on for-profit commercial sites like eBay and Amazon with their resellers, and yet it's fragile, if not absent online, on social media discussions around politics. Why? It reflects the political priorities of the tech world to date, and an understanding of free speech curiously ignorant of our own digital reality. This reality makes it easy for a country like Russia or another country to wage a propaganda and influence war on the West. It will also make it easy for private sector companies to do the same against private sector targets one day, if it's not already happening. So now that I've talked a little bit about how we got here, let me talk a little bit about what the tech world can do to defend itself and society. Right now, we're seeing all sorts of mischief being marketed as free speech. White nationalists, conspiracy theorists, identitarians, radicals. Now even, I've read a Russian pundit crying out for free speech in the US. We saw anonymous social media accounts do this during the 2016 presidential campaign. More recently, at the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, which brought together white nationalists, the cause was framed as a protest around free speech. Who has rightful access to our democratic discussion is a key issue. But as we've seen, for legal and moral and cultural reasons, the tech world is extremely reluctant to address this topic. Clearly, some speech is coordinated to disrupt the whole system, while some is just plain unpopular. But where do you draw the line? Free speech gets a bit murkier here. History gives us a way to look at this. In the 1940s and 50s, the Cold War was in full swing. American communists, ultimately answerable to Moscow, were active in US unions. What worried many Americans was that the communist ideology required the overthrow of capitalist governments. Moreover, in order to advance communism in the US, party members followed Vladimir Lenin's instruction to use all sorts of stratagems, maneuvers, illegal methods, evasions, and subterfuges in order to achieve their end. So, there was the idea of the overthrow of the US government, then also tactics that went beyond simply arguing for it. Clearly, there was the right to argue on popular ideas, like a communist revolution, but how far could communists go in pursuing their rights? When did it violate free speech? U.S. courts found that the ideas of communism weren't the issue as much as the coordinated actions taken by members. In other words, subversive actions were the issue, not simply subversive ideas. Political philosopher Sidney Hook articulated the difference as the distinction between heresy, promoting controversial ideas, and conspiracy, taking coordinated actions to cripple the whole of democracy. The failure, Hook wrote, to recognize the distinction between heresy and conspiracy is fatal to a liberal civilization. I think we're at a similar point today. The technology has changed, but the principles haven't, especially when you see trolls and nation states subvert the technology's use. But the heresy versus conspiracy axiom provides a line the tech world, including social media platforms, should be considering. If information is being used to strategically confuse and cripple our democracy, should the promoters of that information enjoy unfettered access to the platforms used to spread it? Maybe a fundamental democratic right in the 21st century, in a time of unlimited flows of speech, is the right to access sensible political discourse. The world has changed dramatically since the early 1990s when cyberspace was being conceived as an idea. Not only does elite media no longer have a stranglehold on speech, Western democracies now have credible great power rivals. But there is, I think, a crucial shift that's happened too, one that the public has to be aware of if they want to understand the tech culture that is now so permissive of outside influence. In the past 30 years, the internet has dramatically changed society. As recently as the end of the 1980s, in a more industrial economy with limited information, institutions were stronger in society and could demand more conformity. Individuals then sought freedom and counterculture. Now, as the internet reshapes our economy and our experience of each other, the social power of those institutions, the government, the military, religious institutions, even social traditions, has faded. We have a world in which the individual is not at risk of being crushed by the conforming pressure of society's expectations as much as unraveled by the lack of direction and cohesive community. So the atomized individual, rather than going underground with like-minded individuals on the outside of institutions in a time of information scarcity, instead now lives in a time of information overload. He or she can choose any cause, any belief, any interest. And yet, it can also be isolating and paralyzing. And so there's a natural urge to want to find a community online to join, or a group, or a cause. I think we've seen this with some of the alienated young men online these days. It's in this context that Russia could organize real-life political rallies in the U.S. With pressure to conform to society much more absent, there is no social or cultural or political force preventing you from sleepwalking into tyranny, unwittingly or otherwise, as long as it gives you a sense of personal meaning. And I think that Russian propagandists understand this. All of this suggests that now, with the internet having shifted our world, that after exhausting the potential of the communitarian subculture to tech, the drive in society has reversed from an anxiety to break free of the homogenizing center to an urge to reach out to find identity and belonging somewhere, anywhere. Potentially then, the changed need in the tech world is one needed outside as well. And that is the need for an identity and sense of belonging around the ideas and culture of Western democracy. Orient your values and the code will follow, as it were. But the tech community's role is essential. If it embraces ideas that weaken democracy, it will make saving democracy harder. Likewise, if Silicon Valley creates platforms that result in the end of law-based democracy, the problems tech elites think that they can simply ignore will come back to haunt them, and soon. 19th century law lecturer Henry Sumner Maine wrote that the shift in social relations from a primitive society to a modern society was a shift from a society in which relationships were determined by status to a society in which relationships were determined by contract. With enough erosion of democracy and the culture of law, we in the West will drift from a society in which your rights matter to one in which your wealth and privilege and connections and followers, your status, is the sole determinant factor. There are many stories in Australia of citizens from Australia who go into business in China and lose everything they've built there in a court case, in part because they don't have the status within that system. contract doesn't mean the same thing in a kleptocracy. As Western politics grow more confused and its political values more corroded, corruption will be normalized here. Clearly, Russia and China have a right to their place in the world. That is not up for debate. But if their success relies on wrecking our democratic information space, then a natural, legitimate tension and lasting point of difference can be discerned. The campaign, then, is for the future, to ensure that our democratic values, which undergird the modern world, are adapted into our new digital reality. Now, it can all seem very daunting, but consider this. Every generation must defend democracy anew. For many of us, our grandparents and great-grandparents did it in the 1940s and again in the 50s. Now we must defend democracy by recasting it for the digital world the West helped create, but failed to fully understand. Thank you. Now, if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to. Jenna will bring the mic's just there in the middle. No, there's one just there.
Who owns the tension between access to content and the truth of content?
Who owns the tension? Sorry?
Right, so you've got the digital world throwing content out there untested in a lot of times. So is it democracy? Is it the government? Is it the technology companies? Who owns... Who needs to own that in order to bridge that gap?
I think it's something that's going to have to be... I think the issue, the significant issue, is that you have... that the tech community can understand exactly what is necessary for... necessary speech in a democracy for it to function. And they cannot let their information streams be completely corrupted. So... I think it would be hard to say exactly who owns it, but it's going to be a matter of collaborative work together between the various stakeholders, so the tech sector, the government, and the public. And like anything else, I would assume it would be a work in progress. I don't know that because social media and new technology is constantly evolving, it seems like it's a conversation that would be evolving as well, and there wouldn't be one single answer to that.
Hi. So most people that are in tech were born in the 70s, 80s, or later. They have no clue what you're talking about. It's not scary enough. They can't imagine an authoritarian world. And the message that, I mean, that should have been a much bigger speech. Much more people should listen. But the message is too complex. So you think that before a real catastrophe, and I don't know, maybe the last elections were, but perhaps bigger than that, people will actually pay attention. Like, what needs to happen for that to become...
It's one of the most curious elements of this time that we're in, because I've gone to a couple of these sessions talking about similar things, and we've had people stand up where there'd be a small number of people, and they'd stand up and they'd say it's unbelievable how few people in the audience have come to hear this for what is essentially a national emergency. And I think part of the nature of this national emergency is that it has this quality of an opt-in problem. You can choose to follow it or choose not to follow it. But that, to me, is the essence of the struggle that we're facing. So some people are in some rooms and they know that the red lights are flashing and the bell's ringing, and other people are carrying on their merry way. So how do you get from the people that are aware of the problem to the people that are absolutely disengaged and in a productive, in a way that galvanizes them but doesn't alarm them? It's something. I mean, I think this is a challenge. That's the nature of the challenge, right there. You turn to your neighbor and you say, this is a real issue. It's something we're going to have to think about, and we're going to have to work towards a solution for.
So my question is about some of your comments about Silicon Valley culture, and I wonder the extent to which it's actually bled beyond Silicon Valley culture, and it's actually entered the popular consciousness in a lot of democracies recently. And you've kind of got these parallel, and I'll try and explain it as briefly as I can, but you've kind of got these parallel forces of kind of level one is government institutions aren't really necessary because I don't see them doing very much for me. So that's kind of level one disengagement, right? Then you've got level two disengagement, which I think is I use the word beautifully, but beautifully ugly described in Julian Assange's white paper, which basically portrays our entire political system as a conspiracy. And his logic is, because there are state secrets, the state is keeping secrets from you. Therefore, the state is a conspiracy. Therefore, I'm going to disrupt that conspiracy. So, you know, I sort of wonder how deep the rot has gone, and then what measures you need to take, because it's kind of, you know, it's disengagement through active. We all ride in taxis, right? How often have you heard just the craziest conspiracy theories from, you know, the average taxi driver? And it just happens to me on a regular basis when I talk to them. So I'm just curious, like, your thoughts on that.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, these problems, talking about the tech sector, it reflects the wider society. And one of the issues that's come about in the past 2 years is that what we're talking about here, and even things with the propaganda online, it cuts right into the bigger political discussion that we're in. I think in a lot of Western democracies, we're all sort of due for some sort of reboot. You know, a lot of the institutions and a lot of the expectations are built around a manufacturing economy, and now we're in this new digital reality. So that changes expectations in the relationship between the citizen and the government. So anything that addresses this sort of matter will likely also address the bigger issue of the citizen and democracy. And I think you're right. The lure of, say, libertarianism, and I don't want to just pick on that, but the lure of it is something that has shaped in the U.S., it's shaped politics here. In Australia, not to the same extent, but there is this sort of fading, I think, of the view of sort of a shared society, and that's what that I think needs to be recovered. And I think that if that happens, that would benefit this situation. And if this situation can be resolved, it might benefit the broader political society.
So I studied political communication and history at the University of Texas, and since then have gone on to become a social media marketer, which is what I do now. I've worked in hospitality sector, and now I work in insurance brokerage and consulting as the in-house work that we do. And so Facebook has been a really big constant in my life from studying in school. It was a feature of my academic work even a decade ago in political communication. And now, obviously, as a social media marketer, I'm in the platform every day. And one of the things that has always frustrated me about it is the complete lack of accountability. Mm-hmm. That you have this now, one of the most powerful, you know, whatever you want to call it, media companies, technology companies, communications platforms in the world, that seems to operate with very little access. You know, I, reaching out for support if I have a technical issue, or it's almost impossible to connect with somebody. Yet at conferences like this, whether I'm attending seminars on branding and marketing, or I've been to some as well because it's the industry I'm in, on healthcare reform, diversifying workplaces, the themes that you keep hearing right now all the time are about, you know, really connecting to the needs of the community and having the community at the table and that level of accessibility. And it just, when I see what's going on now, it really makes me wonder about whether there is a connection to a company like Facebook that's entire operating structure is based on an almost complete lack of transparency and accountability and connection to their users, marketing themselves as being the ultimate communication tool. And I just wonder if there's some connection there that you see between a lack of accountability and connection to the types of problems like this.
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, I think that when a lot of this happens, it happens because no one's home at Facebook to stop it. And that also is what makes them so profitable. They can be in everybody's life, but have so few people, so few humans actually overseeing that. I mean, regarding Russian influence operations on Facebook, I think if the company, I mean, this is just my opinion, one of the simplest fixes that they could do right now is a buddy system where you have a technologist at Facebook and have them with a political scientist that can identify opinions and behavior that is not consistent with that country's political opinions and behavior, and then that's a good place to look for weird influence. But that's like completely, I don't think that's something that they're discussing. I know they have country-specific experts, but I don't know how much that's valued in the company. you know, because they see themselves, I mean, rightfully so, as a technology company. But if they're in every aspect of life, it seems like they need to develop that. And then if that's the case, then they become a very different company. So it's a, you know, it's a conundrum. I mean, it is, but it's also one that's worth following, you know, worth pursuing. Because when we unpack this, then we'll get to some sort of more stable society. I really believe, in my experience, working on a foreign news desk, we see things online where, because we look at things through international politics, myself and colleagues can point to stuff and say, that doesn't make any sense at all. And we know it immediately, but then you know that it's passing through people's news feeds that might not know, and they're liking it and retweeting it, and there's no natural place to stop and to investigate this. So, yeah, no, I agree. It's the irony, or the, you know, it's the conundrum of Facebook. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
There we go. Okay, thanks. Hi, my name is Christopher Guess. I'm probably one of those hackers and crypto activists, I guess you call us, that you're speaking about. Listening to your speech, I believe there's a fundamental misunderstanding in your thought about tech, in that you basically only look at Silicon Valley, call everyone their tech and hackers, and then apply that to the entire Western world. As an example, I'd like to invite you to the Chaos Computing Congress held in Germany for the last 35 years between Christmas and New Year's. If you come, you'll find that almost none of your assumptions are accurate. What you're equating to libertarianism is actually business owners, right? Mark Zuckerberg is not a hacker. He learned PHP and then quickly shifted it over and started hiring other people. Jeff Bezos is not a hacker. He's a businessman. Peter Thiel is the exact opposite of what pretty much everybody in the community believes in. We're often wildly inclusive, very democratic, far left. You equated us to fascists and talked about Pinochet at one point in time. We're not. I mean, where do these ideas come from? You clearly didn't engage in the wider community at all. And thank you.
Okay. I'm happy to talk to you afterwards if you want to know where I got the talk on Pinochet, for example. But you, as I said, you cannot deny the influence of libertarianism in the original ideas around some of the technology that was coming from Silicon Valley. That is part of, according to people that have studied it very closely, including Fred Turner from Stanford, that is part of the originating, germinating idea around some of this technology that now I don't think that we actively question. Because it's in the air around us. It is part of the culture in as much, you know, much like France has a culture. You don't question certain things about it. It is just that way. And so that is part of the world that we're living in. The example that this gentleman just gave about how Facebook doesn't seem to be really connected to these things. I think in the technology culture, there's the elegance in the engineering. That is something that's really highly prized. Is that right?
Yes, but look at the entirety of Europe, right? They question this in their politics and government every day. Maybe not as much in the States, but this is being questioned within many communities around the world. Oh. Just maybe not in one part, you know, just outside of Marin County.
Yeah, but the thing is, what's happening, yeah, but Silicon Valley has, as you would, I'm sure, agree, has a huge influence on our life around us, whether we like it or not. I mean, they are the first movers into the space. They helped shape this new reality that we all live in perforce, whether we like or not. So, you know, granted, and I said, it's not that all people in the tech world are libertarian, but it is a tribe. I mean, I think you would agree. It's a tribe, and it has its own culture and custom, and to any change in that would be very hard, I think. But I also think that that's something that, you know, has to change in order to address these other bigger issues that we're looking at now, because so much of the mindset around tech in the West is around cybersecurity, which is a reflection of our Western culture. I'm not going to tell you what to say. I'm just going to make sure that the platform that you say it on is free and open and free from you know, interruption. That's a reflection of our values, our Western values. Well, now we've got this other problem, who people have a very different idea of information. Information security are happy to weigh in on that and pervert a lot of the ideas that we have. And they have a pretty good, I think, they have a decent knowledge, a better knowledge of us than we do of them, for historical reasons. And that's the heart of it. I'm completely glad to continue this conversation. And just for your information, last night I was at the EFF Austin event, and it was good. I got a lot out of it, but it didn't really change my broader view. I got some great people there, great conversations with them, but it didn't change my overall view. But I'm happy to talk to you afterwards if you'd like. Well, I mean, they're slowly making the right sounds, I guess, about what to do, but it's the follow through. And again, I mean, I think that this also reflects our technological economy. They are so successful and they're so used to dealing with issues through PR and through managing public expectations that they might not understand that they've got an existential, like, problem here. It's not going to be, they can't just wave that wand and make it go away. It's going to be, it's going to take some real thinking. I know, I understand that Facebook is, that the people in charge of information security at Facebook are serious about their job, that they take it seriously. But within Facebook, I don't know how powerful they are. My understanding from what I hear is that they don't have, you know, that they make their case, but they're not necessarily the ones that are getting to drive the agenda, you know. And that, and so you have Mark Zuckerberg talking about how it's his personal, you know, it's personal goal, but it's just not what we're, what, you know, it's not, that's not what's going to save democracy. Is if it's his personal thing, it's got to be for everybody. It's got to be a shared sort of effort across the country and across the company and society. So short answer, no, not a lot, not a lot. Yeah, is that? Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much for coming.